Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Yesterday in California, when two of America's most powerful politicians got together, it was not a moment for grandiloquent speech-making. The national leaders did not move to the microphones with carefully crafted texts. No. The first encounter between Republican President George Bush and the Republican governor-elect Arnold Schwarzenegger was a time for plain speaking.
When I came to this country 35 years ago, I never imagined in my wildest dreams that I will be standing in front of you here as the governor-elect of California and introducing the President of the United States.
During that visit, I was able to reflect upon how much we have in common. We both married well. Some accuse us both of not being able to speak the language.
Now, when the President of the United States is able to win congratulatory applause with his disdain for fancy talk, it is as if he is adding punctuation to the latest book by the linguist John McWhorter. The book's called Doing Our Own Thing, The Degradation of Our Language and Music, and Why We Should, Like, Care. Before you reach for the scan button to avoid what you think is going to be another left-wing NPR screed against the president's struggle with the English language, just hold on for a second. This isn't about Bush. McWhorter says the degradation of language began in the mid-60s. He says the public slide away from reverence for the spoken word continues to this day, and it's hurting more than American politics. He says it threatens the very culture of this country. So, Connection listeners, do you think that America's political language has been degraded, or are simpler and more casual words a better way to communicate? This change in language, is it to be feared and resisted, or is this the natural way that language evolves? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest is the linguist, cultural critic, John McWhorter. His new book is called Doing Our Own Thing, The Degradation of Language and Music, and Why We Should, Like, Care. You heard the president and the governor-elect yesterday. You must have had the same sort of thought going through your
uncanny.
Mind.
It's uncanny that he would come up with that right when this book comes out. It really shows what a different culture we are from even the recent past. You know, there's the outing of witches. We look at that America and we think, well, that's a different time. We have to work our way around figuring out how that made sense. We now are a very linguistically different culture than we used to be. When it is funny for a president to be that inarticulate, it's just a tip of an iceberg. It shows that in the society, we don't value dressing up our language as much as we used to.
Well, more than funny, it is something that people want to agree with the president about. When the president says enough of this fancy talk, this is sort of exhaling of breath. People go, right.
Exactly.
I agree with you. I want to, if I can, John, go back to the beginning of your book, because you use a brilliant example here of just how far we have come from the way that speeches used to be made. You refer to what we should probably call the other Gettysburg address.
Right. Good old Edward Everett. And he stood up there before Lincoln spoke, and he ran his mouth for 2 hours. And he was just giving a kind of potted history. It wasn't even very interesting what he was saying.
Here's a copy of it. It's 18 pages, single-spaced.
It goes on and on. And it's in, you know, he says things along the lines of, you know, whose pathways gleamed with the monuments of the illustrious dead, the work of the most consummate masters that ever gave life to marble. There, beneath the overarching plane trees, upon a lofty stage erected for the purpose, it was ordained that a funeral oration should be pronounced by some citizen of Athens in the presence of the assembled multitude, etc., etc. And this is the kind of oratory that he wrote this in, and he went on like this for 2 hours. He was a rock star. He was known for speaking. He did other things in life.
This wasn't a person who everybody went, oh my God, here's Everett again. Let's open the picnic basket and wait for Lincoln.
They stood there on that blowsy day, and they were mesmerized. He was known for being a speaker. He did other things in his life, none of them all that well. He was known for being a guy who spoke well. And in that America, you could be famous for being an orator. And what's interesting about Edward Everett and people sitting there for as long as it would take to watch Pulp Fiction listening to this man is that we couldn't do that today. We wouldn't want to listen to him, nor would we want to listen to anybody using a heightened form of English like that, using a spoken kind kind of English, maybe. But using the artful, artificial, written form of English like that, that's not something that's part of our souls today, and that's because we have a different relationship to language than those very American people in 1863.
Now, there's another part of the history that I'm not sure is accurate, but it's said that Everett was asked to join this dedication ceremony for the Gettysburg Cemetery in mid-September, and he said, well, if you want me speaking, you'll have to do it later. So they said, that's fine,
and
we'll do it in mid-November.
And they did.
And he had 2 months to prepare this speech.
He actually prepared an oration. And in our America today, there's barely an equivalent of such a thing. If you were going to speak on an occasion, the idea that it would take you 2 months to work something up is rather peculiar. We'd think of it as overdoing it. I mean, after all you're going to be doing is talking to some people. And the aim of our speeches tends to be to sound as folksy as possible. And that is something that an Edward Everett wouldn't have recognized. When you spoke, you weren't trying to sound like you sounded when you got up in the morning. You were doing something different. We don't do that anymore, and that gives us a different relationship to our language than we used to, and a different one than in many other countries.
Well, John, let's move ahead, if we can, to the mid-60s, because I think that's the point that you mark in history when, certainly in this country,
definitely,
the value in a prepared text disappears.
Yeah, it happens then, and it's almost amazing how abrupt it is. And so if you read Newton Minow's speech against television of the period as being a vast wasteland, immediately we read that now and it seems old style. It's just 1961. It's the Dick Van Dyke Show era, but it's an old-fashioned speech. Go to 1972 and read Jane Fonda's Radio Hanoi speech, and she's trying, but more or less, she's just talking, and it's not something bad she was doing. She was part of the new American culture where you didn't make those kinds of formal speeches anymore. And, of course, during this era, there were still elderly people who were still doing it. Robert Byrd still does this today. Senator Robert Byrd, he's well past 80. He still talks in the old-fashioned way, or tries to. But it happens in the 1960s, and it's the result of the counterculture, in my opinion.
Let's listen, if we can, to a little bit of the type of speaking that we're talking about. I had a couple of notes here, and I just need to refer then to this would be just a tiny little bit, John, from President Kennedy's inaugural address, January 20th, 1961.
In the long history of the world, only a few generations have been granted the role of defending freedom in its hour of maximum danger. I do not shrink from this responsibility. I welcome it. I do not believe that any of us would exchange places with any other people or any other generation. The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world.
When Kennedy speaks, his words are not big, long, fancy words. But,
no.
But there's something about the way that they're put together, which...
Yeah, there are two things that you hear there. One, they're put together in a way that maximally shows off human voice and intonation. Clearly, his speechwriters worked very hard on that.
And they knew how he spoke.
And they knew how he spoke, and they had a certain kind of training. And notice also the theatrical pitch that he's using, even though he's standing in front of a microphone. And of course, Edward Everett, before amplification, had to shout. So naturally, that gave a certain theatrical cast to what he was doing. But Kennedy is standing in front of a mic. You know, he can be heard. And yet, there's a theatrical air, despite the fact that he, as a person, was not the most theatrical person. That's because even he is from a time where clearly he thinks of himself as making a speech. Clinton is a very articulate man. That's not how Clinton would have done a speech. The theater was gone. That's because Clinton is very much an after-the-counterculture product.
Let's listen to a little bit of Bill Clinton. This is from a tiny little bit of his speech given as a eulogy for the victims of the Oklahoma City bombing. So this would have been in late April 1995, Oklahoma City.
Let us teach our children that the God of comfort is also the God of righteousness. Those who trouble their own house will inherit the wind. Justice will prevail. Let us let our own children know that we will stand against the forces of fear. When there is talk of hatred, let us stand up and talk against it.
And when I listen to the contrast there, I mean, there are no phrases there like defending freedom in its hour of maximum danger, though they're very sort of poignant moments in American
right.
history. But what else would you have me hear in what Clinton says or the way that he uses the language there?
Well, in the way that he uses or the way his speechwriters there were using the language, what you have is an admirable clarity, and there's certainly an attempt to have an elegiac tone. And so all of this is fine. Certainly it's not that everybody who makes a speech just talks. But you notice that that language is by no means as almost exaggeratedly wrought as Edward Everett's was, nor is it as dramatic or very carefully poised as something, say, an FDR would have delivered. We have an emphasis upon the spare and the simple, and that brings us towards spoken kind of language as opposed to the artificial tapeworm nature of written language.
But isn't that in large part because Clinton and his people would have known in 1995 that most Americans would consume that speech by watching Clinton from about the same distance that we are apart right now on,
right.
on the television screen,
right.
With the face about the same size. And so it becomes, in a way, more personal.
There is an intimacy aspect, certainly. And so the first bump in the change of speeches happens with electric amplification in the 20s. And so Franklin D. Roosevelt was by no means as much of a theatrical performer as, say, a William Jennings Bryan, and the phraseology of his speeches was not as baroque. But you do see a major difference in the mid-60s. And it's important to remember that even when people are relatively close together, the notion that the language becomes sparer is not necessarily an absolute connection. And so, for example, back in the day when people were drilled in oratory and rhetoric in classrooms, one was expected to be able to do these sorts of things and perform these sorts of things, even in relatively intimate settings. And so it depends. It's just a cultural difference, I think, between what I call BC and AD, which in this case is before 1965.
So children, when we were at school, it wasn't an uncommon thing for the English teacher to say, you're going to have to memorize this
mm-hmm.
passage. You're going to have to stand up in front of the class
mm-hmm.
and recite that passage. This doesn't go on. I don't
rarer,
believe...
much rarer. I missed it, actually, going to school in the 70s. I don't remember having to memorize anything. And that's because of a distrust of rote learning, which in its way is also tied into a countercultural shift, the idea that children should be taught to learn how to learn. And there is some sense in these things. But all of this is based on focusing on the individual and the spontaneous rather than adhering to externally imposed norms. I think that same impulse extends its fingers through our society, and one of those ways is that we're encouraged to speak the way we want to, the way that's spontaneous, the way that we learned, rather than mastering the artifice of a written formal form.
Although, interesting enough, Connection listeners, there are other countries and other languages around the world just as developed as the United States, which still pay tremendous heed to the formal way of expression. We'll talk a little bit more about that when we come back after the break. My guest is John McWhorter. We're talking about his new book, Doing Our Own Thing, The Degradation of Language and Music, and Why We Should Like Care. So, Connection listeners, why should we like care? I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. This is The Connection. The linguist and cultural critic John McWhorter writes regularly in the New Republic and the Wall Street Journal. He has a number of books out called Authentically Black, The Power of Babel, Losing the Race, Self-Sabotage in Black America. His new book is called Doing Our Own Thing, The Degradation of Language and Music and Why We Should Like Care. That's actually in the title. John McWhorter is my guest this hour on The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And Connection listeners, we'd like to you to have us join our conversation about language. Is it fair to say that in Germany, John, and in Russia and in Italy, that the love of language means that some of that formal speaking
mm-hmm.
style still lives, and it does, and it's not seen as a cartoon of language
That's
today?
That's very much the case. And so, for example, Russians, in their education system today, are still trained to be able to rattle off Pushkin. Whatever kind of person you are in real life, you can take a Russian teenager, they will rattle off Pushkin, tight meter, tight rhymes, and savor it. They'll love it the way we love reciting Horton Hears a Who or something like that. You can notice in Italian society that there is still a tradition where public debate is carried on in a kind of hyper-elegant language. You know, not Latin, but not the Italian of the streets. And to not do that would be like us not wearing deodorant. That's just what you do. You dress up the language. And Italians have a certain language pride. Great Britain, even though to an extent a lot of what's happening here is happening there too because they take our cue from us culturally so much, they have a certain love of English that we don't. They have a radio show there on BBC called Just a Minute. And one of the things it does is it challenges you to orate for 60 seconds on some topic. And people do that with varying degrees of proficiency. What's interesting is we wouldn't have that. You know, even on NPR, that doesn't sound like an American sport. The Brits find language cuter than we do. There's something about being American that leads us to just talk instead of thinking about our noble, mighty English language. The Russians have that, a phrase like that. We don't.
Are these class distinctions at all? When you talk about Great Britain, for example, I think of the Rex Harrison, the rain in Spain falls mainly on the plain. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether or not it's a perpetuation of a higher educated class and mm-hmm. that people will still aspire to that in Italy or Russia. Mm-hmm. Or because exactly what we were talking about earlier in the program here in America is happening in Great Britain. They have television. They have radio. They have this same wash of the spoken word mm-hmm. wherever they go.
It's true. And that's why I think that there is a kind of isolated factor. These other things matter. But once you take away all the other things, you notice that there's a certain something. And even class can mislead us sometimes because there was a time, as we all know, when Shakespeare, in diluted form, but Shakespeare was beloved by what you might call the unlettered classes. I'm going to pull a random example because it's the only thing I can think of right now. There is a great monologuist, Ruth Draper, from back in the day. She was a patrician woman. She was known for getting up on stage and doing all these, you know, voices for long periods of time. One of her voices is a working class woman in Maine. And the working class woman in Maine, a sort of person that Draper had observed on vacations, is casually swooning over how her son liked to read passages of Shakespeare and could recite them. This is a woman without education. Mm-hmm. That was a slice of life. That was an American person that Draper probably encountered in the 1910s, and now we have today, where that wouldn't translate into our modern culture at all. Oh, how I love to listen to my son recite Shakespeare. That's not us.
So what is it, John? Because it's not that people in this country don't value education. Mm-hmm. We know they do. It's mm-hmm. not. This isn't just, you know, the English Language Teachers Association saying we're going to teach rap lyrics instead of right. Shakespeare. Although you point out that's a
not
little,
too
a
far.
Part of it.
Yeah, there's a little of that.
I get that, but somewhere deeper inside the American soul mm-hmm. is this willingness to say, don't like that fancy talk. It's arcane. It's what's the word I'm looking for that. Pretentious.
Oh, there
is the
you
word.
Go. Okay.
That I don't want to listen to that.
Right. I think, you know what I think it is? A lot of it is that kind of language takes effort. That's the difference between oral and written. You have to be taught written language. Whatever it did is a trick, in a way. It's an artifice. All of us know how to do what we're doing right now. Then there's this other English, and that takes work, and you're subscribing to an external norm. And so the reason that this becomes kind of noxious in, you know, the educational establishment, in us in many ways, I think, is because that is not doing your own thing. You're not finding your inner muse. It's not spontaneous. That is quite against the spirit of 1968. And we're a long way from 1968 now, but we've inherited a kind of a tick from that era, which is that fancy language is not something to swoon to. It's uncool. It's irrelevant. And here we are.
I want to go back to 1969 and listen to a speech that a lot of people fought at the time. Well, you gave it to me. What can I say? Was pretty cool speaking. And this is Jesse Jackson, a speech. I think this was recorded in Chicago in 69. But we'll all know the pattern.
Yeah! somebody. I may be uneducated, but I am somebody. I may have been in jail, but I am somebody. I am black. I'm beautiful. I'm God's child.
Can't say the guy didn't have the attention of the audience.
No, they like that. Yeah.
But you draw a pretty heavy, dark line here between what you call the use of language in a political speech and the use of language in preaching. What's the difference there?
Yeah, that's an important question. What Jesse Jackson does is clearly a marvelous thing. It's very stirring. As I say in the book, you'd have to be a corpse not to be stirred by that, and it's not something that everybody can do. But the preaching tradition, which has been studied, what it is a charismatic channeling of spoken English. Short sentences, non-standard sentences, packaging it all very closely, tightly, and simply with a lot of rhythm, the call and response, so it's a conversation mm-hmm. rather than an isolated recitation. That's fine, but there's a difference between that and the particular type of labor that you put into what somebody used to call an oration. And so you notice that many preachers who are adept in this form will have some basic notes scribbled out, but what they really do on Sunday morning is something rather spontaneous. They often say that it's channeled through God. They never do it the same way mm-hmm. twice. Whereas, of course, Edward Everett could do that the same way again and again and again. It was very tightly set. So both things are good, but there's a difference. Yes, Jesse Jackson is an orator, but not in the way that William Jennings Bryan was an orator. There's a difference.
So when Martin Luther King stands up and does his I Have a Dream speech and does his Let Freedom Ring
right.
pattern, and you write it out in the book, from the mighty mountains, from the heightening Alleghenies, from the snow-capped Rockies, is
right.
that the same call and response? Because if it is, then he's mixing that with a quality of oratory, which is...
Yeah. King was kind of a hybrid in that way, because, yeah, there is a spoken rhythm and the call and response in I Have a Dream, but clearly there's something more. The particular choices of words are rather elevated and involve quite a bit of work. Like, for example, looking at how King worked on his speeches versus how Jackson does it. King was somebody who was more of a laborer in this vein than Jackson. Jackson is doing what the anonymous preacher on Sunday morning might do. Well, they does it well. King was part of the BC culture in his way. He knew that he was writing speeches, but there's definitely a major oral flavor in it that, say, an FDR speech did not have.
1-800-423-8255. Let's take our first call now from Watertown, Massachusetts, and it's Josette joining us. Hi, Josette.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
No problem. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to bring up the issue of register. If I'm saying this right, it's a linguistic term that implies that you speak differently depending on which context you're in. If you are talking to children, you're going to speak differently than if you're talking in a adult audience, if you're speaking
that
to your parents,
right.
you're going to speak different, than you would to your friends.
That's right.
And I was a high school teacher for 2 years, and I noticed that my students didn't really have the ability to change registers. They tended to speak to me as their teacher the same way they would speak to their friends. They
right.
didn't see anything wrong with swearing in class. They would take a punishment, you know, knowing the class rules,
mm-hmm.
but they wouldn't realize that it was wrong
mm-hmm.
to speak the same way they would to their friends and they would to their teachers, to their parents,
mm-hmm.
to the principal even. You know, they really didn't see a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they also found it difficult to work on making their writing more elevated
mm-hmm.
than normal everyday conversation.
Mm-hmm.
They had a hard time reading anything that wasn't in a conversational tone that
mm-hmm.
was even slightly elevated. I gave them my ninth graders King's I Have a Dream speech,
mm-hmm.
and my class had a very difficult time understanding the language, the metaphors, had
mm-hmm.
a very difficult time trying to understand the specific points that he was making. They understood his main point, but
yeah.
they didn't understand, for example, I remember there was a metaphor, something like we shall all sit down on the shared table. and speak of things. I don't remember the exact sentence, but they didn't understand how the table could be used as a metaphor for everyone sitting down and understanding one another.
Yeah, you're referring to a very important difference. And of course, we don't want to condemn the kids because you speak the language that you know, but what's interesting is that there was a time when about every second student didn't get past eighth grade. It was very ordinary. And yet, 100 years ago, what was pounded into your head by eighth grade is beyond what a lot of college undergraduates get today, which shows that this was just a different world where values were placed differently than we place them now. I know I've been living in New York, and just listening, I'm only 38, and so profanity doesn't have the same meaning to me that it does to my elders, etc. But the language, as elderly as it sounds, the language that I'm hearing 12 and 13-year-olds using in the New York subway is showing me that we really are closing this boundary between the formal and the informal in favor of the former. But I definitely know what you mean.
So you also describe this gap where academics write for academics at a level of prose which is somewhat impenetrable for most other people. And having been an academic, I guess you can throw these rocks yourself.
Right. That the kind of high academic prose that's used particularly in literary studies is a different kind of extreme. It's this kind of impenetrable prose with very specific uses of highly obscure words. And it gets to the point where a brilliant literary scholar, I shouldn't say in order to, because it makes it sound like they are doing it because they have to. They can't help it. The way they write their material is such that nobody without a PhD could get through it. That is another symptom of a loss of love of our language, because in the same way as you can let the language go back towards the spoken, well, you know, if you have your own little language that you can share with 400 or 500 people, it's good for you. You guys have a kind of a code between you, like two twins who make up their own language. Now, the fact is that 40 years ago, I think many academics would have been ashamed to write that way. You weren't dressing up the language properly to be that unclear. Once that impulse is gone, then you can almost predict that a certain caste will start writing in that hideous, prickly, impenetrable way. They don't think they're better than other people. It's often said that they write that way as some sort of ego thing. It's not like that at all. Most of the people who write that way are very nice people who usually don't think very much about the fact that their writing is impenetrable. They tend to forget how impenetrable it is. But ultimately, they are less concerned with the style of the language than professors two generations before would quite understand.
Okay, Josette, thanks for that call. Next to Nashville, Tennessee, Freddie's joining us. Hi, Freddie.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks.
Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. I think one thing that's been hinted at today, but maybe hasn't been directly addressed, is the fact that in the span of human history, we've got two relatively recent trends going on, and one is participatory democracy, and the other is mass media. And it's really only in the last century that those two things have kind of been joined. So I think when one is speaking now or creating, I mean, I think it's interesting that music is in the title of the book as well, but when one is creating a message now, it basically is something that has to be expressed in a greatest common factor sort of way in order for people to feel like it is participatory. And I think that, you know, that's great that one of the strengths of democracy is that it does make the process of embracing a message much more participatory. But I think on the other hand, it runs the risk of making every message that is going to be sustainable, whether it's, you know, from the sense of revenue or from the sense of getting elected or from the sense of being able to sustain oneself as an artist, it means that the message really does have to be tailored in every case to be relevant to the medium which
it's being expressed. I think there's certainly truth in that, except that there are some time lags that make us want to nuance that point. And so, for example, mass culture and mass literacy didn't necessarily only come together at the end of the 20th century. Even earlier in the 20th century, say around the 20s, when movies become a massive industry, you had a similar confluence. Look in a fan magazine, a movie fan magazine from, say, 1931, and read the level of prose. It would be considered quite imposing compared to the equivalent of that magazine today, say Premiere. And yet, those magazines were aimed at, you know, ordinary shop girls and shop boys or whatever the male equivalent of that word is. So I think that there's something to that, but I think something special did happen in the 1960s.
Freddie, do you think that then something, if something's lost, something may have been gained at the same time because that because whatever message is manufactured or given is accessible to a wider group of people?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think it's a trade-off, and I'm actually a little bit curious to know, the title of the book expresses that we should care, you know, why we should care, and I'm just wondering if caring is one thing, you know, I mean, caring and doing something about it are two different things, and I'm actually kind of curious to know whether or not the author thinks that this is something that we should try to correct. I mean, I definitely sense, you know, I mean, what you're talking about today is that there seems to be almost a breakdown of the cultural elite, and I think it kind of plays back into, you know, my original point in the sense that you end up with more people being able to take part in, for instance, the university system. Or
yeah, it's that's definitely true that there can be a situation where the high language is a gatekeeper of sorts. And so, for example, take Arabic. Written Arabic is a completely different language than any Arabic anybody learns at home, which means that to become an Arab with any influence in society, you have the burden of learning a new language. That's an extreme. And why you should like care, though, I think, and for one thing, is that I think that our wariness of crafted language as opposed to spontaneous language has a lot to do with the eclipse of the place of poetry in this country. And despite occasional protestations that there's a poetry revival, I think that it's a very narrow one. And if you compare the place of poetry in the American fabric in, say, 1930 and to today, there's a major, major narrowing, and that's partly because of the sense that we'd rather hear language the way we speak it than in an artificial form. And I think it also tends to clog up our political discourse to an extent, because it's unfashionable to fashion a seriously closely argued rhetorical piece outside of a small circulation political journal justifying one's policies.
Freddie, thanks a lot for your call. Connection listeners, does the hair on the back of your neck go up if you read or hear something that doesn't sound like ordinary conversation? That's what we're talking about, our own conversation about language here in the Connection with John McWhorter. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. John McWhorter's with me in the studio. His new book is called Doing Our Own Thing, The Degradation of Language and Music and Why We Should Like Care. Let's take a call from Louisville, Kentucky. Kern's waiting on the line. Hi, Kern. Go ahead.
How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Good. I just wanted to comment on some things that you have talked about. Your last caller talked about you know, doing things so everyone could understand.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting how we're in a culture that's more visual than oral. And I'd like to maybe talk a little bit about that and hear your comments on that. And how even music, which is mentioned in your book, you know, we have music videos now. And it's very visual. It's sort of all about what we're seeing. And I'm wondering if that has, I feel that that's a direct connection to why we are using words less.
One of my favorite pictures, Kern, is the politician who stands at a lectern and has to read a speech from a teleprompter, because
yes,
if we were to see a piece of paper in his hand, we'd somehow think that the words didn't have the same weight or value. You know what I mean?
Exactly, yes. Yeah.
We are no longer a print culture, and that definitely affects things. But then I find myself thinking, I guess it depends on what you call a visual culture. Many, many, many indigenous cultures that don't even have writing nevertheless have a love of a sort of champagne version of their language that they break out on ceremonial occasions with different words, longer words, different kinds of sentences, different ways of putting things together. That is their Edward Everett language. That's something you very commonly find in languages spoken just by 5,000 people or something. And to the extent that they effectively don't have print, one would imagine that they could be considered a visual culture because, you know, imagery plays a great role in those cultures. And yet, they still don't cringe at what we would consider pretentious language. But I definitely see what you mean.
I guess my main point is, I mean, even Shakespeare didn't necessarily, I mean, they weren't writing everything down all of the time.
No.
you know, it was very much an oral tradition. It was based on storytelling.
Very much so, yeah.
Based on speech. And that's something that we as Americans, I feel, because I deal with Shakespeare a lot, are very afraid of.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have, now we have instant messages where we say, you know, LOL and mm-hmm. all of that thing. It's almost like we're speaking in symbols, which is goes back to the visual thing, hieroglyphics almost. You know?
That's true. That's definitely true. The visual culture has a lot to do with taking our attention away from these sorts of things. I guess one would have to think about when the culture became visual in this way. Many people would say that this goes as far back as at least the 1940s. Some people would say that something very special happened in 1990, but it's definitely a factor.
Kern, thanks a lot for your call. 1-800-423-8255 to Acton, Massachusetts. Mark's joining us. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks. Go ahead.
Good. Well, intriguing topic. I am concerned about the fact that our devaluation of language has actually spilled over to the point where it makes it more difficult for people to distinguish between different arguments, nuances in arguments. And so you have, it seems to me, people who are not only politicians but people in the news media who should be concerned about being careful in the type of reports they give to people, not distinguishing between nuances of arguments. And the result is that people have, I think, less information available to make up their minds. We've seen this with the build-up to the war.
Do you mean, Mark, that the storytelling skills aren't there, or do you mean that the default position for people who don't have the language you're describing is to say, hey, I'm just going to be on the right wing and give the right wing point of view, or I'm going to be on the left wing, rather than try and find either the language or the thoughts to be more nuanced?
Well, I think part of it's a little bit of both. I think that some of the reporting that's going on today is pretty shoddy. I want to give you one example. Ambassador Wilson, for example, who initially gave the famous quote about how he would be interested in seeing whether Karl Rove could be frog marched out of the White House. Subsequent reports, when he said, well, you know, I don't really know if he had anything to do with it, but I've been told that he was condoning it. Now, that got reported in the media as, well, he's backtracked off his previous allegation that Karl Rove was behind it. But if you actually look at what he said and you critically analyze it, he didn't make an accusation. He simply said he was interested in seeing whether that person was responsible.
You know, the only thing that worries me, other than my voice having cracked just now, you know, the only thing that worries me about what you're saying, and of course you're referring to a reality, is that you can go to a library and go to the political science or the essays section, and you can find books written as far back as the 60s with the same sort of indignant decrying of distortion in the news and lack of reflection. I was suckled on this sort of thing back when I was an undergraduate in the early 80s before the explosion of the shock jock cable stations on TV over the past 8 years or so. So I'm not sure if that's new. That's my response to that, although certainly the degradation of language can only help that. But have we ever been a truly informed news culture? I'm not sure.
When you key your argument, as you do, though, John, to the way that politicians speak, in the mid-1960s, there was a generation in this country that decided it didn't want to listen to what the politicians were saying. It distrusted the politicians.
So that's
right. It was, it didn't want to listen to the prepared text.
Trust no one over 30. That's
right.
And, yeah, tune in, drop out, etc. And that is where you get the change. It started as a rebellion against people's free speech being muzzled on the college campuses. That, of course, makes perfect sense. We're all thankful for that. That grows into a protest against Vietnam, which I think most of us would agree with at this point. That grows into the civil rights movement, ditto, etc. However, it also created a general zeitgeist. It created a shift in how most Americans listen to music and what they valued in music, and it created a new way of public speaking. Now, there were seeds of this in the Beats back in the 50s. You can see these sorts of things. But then it was a minority movement that the old guard could casually condemn as mush-mouthed and unsophisticated. It's in the late 60s that that becomes a norm. And so David Brooks's book, Bobos in Paradise, explains how nowadays even very mild-mannered, rather apolitical people have a hint of the bohemian in them. There's a sense that one is supposed to rebel against the man, even when a lot of us are not even quite sure what or where the man is anymore. Our sense of language responds to that.
But why is it then that the ripples of that distaste for that quality of language coming as they do from politics would spread into the arts, would make us less interested in poetry and watching or listening to Shakespeare, as our earlier mm-hmm. caller was saying?
It all falls into the same kind of category. If it's language too far removed from the spontaneous, then there's a part of you that learns, even now from a previous generation or two, that there's something false or irrelevant about it, or that it's more urgent to attend to things that are more spontaneous and more internal. And that's, it's a part of our souls. So naturally it's going to be in food, it's going to be in music, it's going to condition our response to poetry, it's going to condition our response to language, people, style. It's all there. This book is trying to just be on the linguistic beat about what is a much larger phenomenon.
To Brookline, Massachusetts, Joyce is joining us now. Hi, Joyce, go ahead. Joyce, are you there? Oh, I think we've lost that line to Joyce. To where are we going next? Actually, you know what? I have a question that, well, we get our electronics sorted out here. And it's a reference you make in the book that I don't quite get, so I need you to explain this to me.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lovely little evolution that you describe about the doctor's waiting office, where we used to go in and sit down and pick up something and read it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd go in and sit down and just stare at the wall. And
oh, I know
now we go
about.
In and we yeah. sit down and we flip open the cell phone, and we
yeah.
have to talk to somebody. And I was trying to figure out where that fits in your
right.
mapping of the degradation of language, because I'm one
right.
of these people who still jumps when someone in an airport starts speaking to the air because they have a wireless.
Isn't it weird?
Yeah.
Isn't it strange? Actually, I use the cell phone point to show that I think that this is only going to continue apace. The cell phone is a very interesting invention because it allows us to become hunter-gatherers again. Human beings talk all the time in small groups. That's what you do. In most small groups, to be silent is processed as a little odd. You even use filler language just to keep things going, kind of like our, yep, uh-huh, that sort of thing. You know, people talk. In modern societies, in first world societies, there used to be many situations where very artificially you couldn't talk, like if you were in the car alone. Now the cell phone allows you to talk all the time, and you know, I just got off of a plane. It's interesting how the minute that thing hits the ground, half of the airplane have to click open those cell phones. Half of those people will be business people who really need something. Half of them have nothing whatsoever to say. It's just that they're not used to not talking any more than a bushman would be. And so we become more and more an oral culture, because now we have this device that allows us to do what we all didn't know we wanted to do all the time, which is talk all the time. But that means we're going to read less. Reading was something that we were doing partly because life put us in situations where there was nothing else to do. But when it gets to the point that you can talk on cell phones in the plane, and Lord forbid, but that day I hear is coming, I imagine that the amount of printed material that will be consumed on planes will drop, because I think most people would much rather talk casually for no particular reason than read anything. That is part of being a human being.
Talk casually and say just about nothing, too, mm-hmm. oftentimes. 1-800...
That's what we do.
423-8255. Where are we now? In Chestnut Hill, and Morgan's on the phone. Hi, Morgan.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks for calling.
Thanks for having me. I'm only 24 years old. I was raised by an English teacher and a writer, and I'm listening to everything you're saying, and frankly, I was appalled when the high school teacher came on and said that her students couldn't change register. And I see it at the workplace here, and I hear people, waxing about how, Italian or French is such a beautiful language, and then you try to correct their grammar, and you're reviled. And I'm wondering, what are we trying to accomplish here, gentlemen? Are we trying, is there something we can do? Is there something we should do?
No.
Are we supposed to just let this die, or what? Because I find the language, English language, beautiful. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, there are more words than virtually any other language.
Hold on,
you
Morgan.
Will become part of an embattled minority. And the truth is that I see no signs that this is going to change. And it's not that our language is wearing down to dust. And it's not that it's ever going to get to the point that writing is exactly like we speak. There will always be 17 poetry fanatics, etc. But we are at a point where we are seeing a difference in our society, where I think we should all learn to embrace the many pleasures and richnesses of non-standard and casual speech, because we're going to see more and more of it. So if somebody wants to teach hip-hop lyrics in the classroom, that's a legitimate subject. We better get used to that, because it's at the point where Tennyson and the gang are going to be taught less and less, because they just are not part of our English-speaking souls. And I don't mean to be flippant about it. There are things that I miss about that world that I never lived in. But it would be too easy for me to say that, you know, school teachers need to shape up, etc. That's not the point. Education doesn't teach these things anymore, because education is part of a larger cultural shift. And so really, I'm describing as much as commenting. But I thought that the description of this phenomenon was worth throwing in.
So if there's a certain amount of fashion attached to this, where it becomes fashionable for a politician or an entertainer or some sort of social leader to use a certain type of speech, then where are we going with this? Because if it's cool to be inarticulate, mm-hmm. does it then become even more cool to be even less articulate?
You know, to be perfectly honest, I don't see how much less articulate we could get than what is becoming the norm today without becoming a different species. We might as well just start grunting at each other. I think that there is a limit. It's not going to be that Time magazine is going to be written in casual, choppy speech. There will always be a minority of people concerned with crafted language. We may have hit about the bottom, to the extent that this is bad, about now. I don't think we're in any kind of peril further.
But you don't see a rebound.
I can't imagine how we would possibly rebound unless we had a technological revolution and an ideological revolution. For example, the countercultural impulse, given what's going on in our government right now, that's not going away anytime soon. So I think we're just going to have to sit tight for a very long time.
John, great to have you in the studio.
Thank you for having me.
John McWhorter is on leave from his job as associate professor of linguistics at the University of California, Berkeley. He is at the Manhattan Institute in New York. His new book is called Doing Our Own Thing, The Degradation of Language and Music and Why We Should, Like, Care. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.